minds. Then it was the simple act of pointing the gun, emptying herself of breath, and pulling the trigger. The first one did what it was supposed to do. It went bang. And that sound was a signal to get the rest of the plan going. Kilometers away, Temin and Bones got to work on cutting the conduit from the wind farm that Solo had identified. That knocked out the fence and the turrets. And it's allowed Sinjir to head down under the cover of night to Aram's compound. She spies his shadow darting through the fence now. To keep him on his toes, Jazz pops off more mines ahead of him. The pulse mines detonate with buzzing explosions, leaving behind small craters and a crackling haze of ozone smoke in their wake. He's closing in on the compound. Suddenly, from all around, shutters and doors open up. New shadows emerge, shapes that seem human, but move with an inhuman stutter step. Droids, she thinks, and that's confirmed the moment they ignite fire-red vibroblades from their hands. She sees a dozen of these droids, maybe more, advancing on Sinjir's position. And now, the clock is threatening to break. Down there, outside the compound, the darkness is lit up by strange glowing vibroblades. They draw glowing arcs through the air as they advance towards Sinjir. The ex-Imperial dashes behind an old motivator tiller, killing off shots from his pistol. But it's not enough. That is where Jazz comes in. Her slug thrower kicks and barfs as she takes out one droid after the next. Hard to see in the dark, but she does her best. The droids offer a satisfying rain of sparks every time she peels the skull off one with a hoptanium-jacketed projectile. She thinks, I got this. Confidence, or rather overconfidence, is a blinding force. And it doesn't help that she's got one open eye pressed against the ring of the rifle scope, which means she hears what's coming 1 second too late. Soon as the thirst grass shakes and whispers, Jazz quick rolls over onto her back and points her rifle up. But a thrumming vibroblade ignites in the darkness above her, whipping forward and slicing through the barrel of her slug thrower. It gets stuck there, buzzing and grinding, sparks flying, and the weight of the commando droid presses down against her. She tries kicking the thing off her, but it's like trying to kick an astromech with its legs grav-bolted to the floor. As she struggles uselessly, the droid's second vibroblade lights up and plunges toward her. Jazz jerks her head to the side just as the blade sticks into the hard scrabble ground. Dust and debris sting her cheek. The droid starts to spasm and glow. Its mouthpiece offers a loud announcement.
Destruct sequence engaged.
Slag. The commando droid shines like magma through a broken mantle of stone, and it's vibrating so hard now that Jazz feels like she, too, will rattle to pieces. She struggles to shove the thing off before it detonates, surely taking her with it, leaving her little more than a red streak in a smoking crater. In the distance, she hears Sinjir yelling for her.
I have my own problems, she thinks. If she can just pivot the gun...
The barrel is broken, the vibroblade still stuck in it, but firing a round out will still make a mess of the droid. Maybe... But she needs to aim it toward the thing's head. Her muscles scream as she willfully turns the gun centimeter by miserable centimeter.
Destructing in three.
She grits her teeth, turning the weapon. So close. So close.
Two.
Her finger searches for the trigger.
One.
No. I'm too late.
A laser lances through the air, cutting clean through its steel neck. The droid's head tumbles off the shoulders. Searing metal bits seem to burn holes in the air as the mechanical skull rolls away into the grass. The commando droid's body slumps to the side. That wasn't the culmination of a self-destruct sequence. Someone did that. Someone who steps up to Jazz, standing over her and offering a hand. The rich baritone of John Burrell's voice reaches her.
You know, Amari, I leave you alone for a second and you go make sweet with a droid. You're lucky I'm the jealous type.
Shut it, Barel. Fall in line. Singir needs our help.
She pretends like it's nothing at all that he's come back, that he's chosen loyalty to their little team. She'll never tell him about the flutter in her chest at hearing his voice again. She'll hardly acknowledge it herself, even though it feels like she has a flock of birds trapped inside her ribcage. Inside the house now, inside Aram's compound. Outside, in the dark, lie the sparking bodies of Aram's droids and the smoldering craters of where the mines were. Inside, though, there's nothing. Or rather, no one.
Blast it, Singir says, coming back through the house.
Jazz warns him.
Be careful. We don't know that he didn't trap this place.
Is he here or not?
John Burrell asks. To which Singir responds.
No, he's not here.
And by the way, when the hell did you show up?
Burrell grunts and shrugs.
He's gone, Singir says. Half his computer systems are fried. His droid docks are empty. Either we met the clanking monstrosities that were in there, or he's got a whole gaggle of them marching with him somewhere.
Where'd he go?
Jom asks.
I don't exactly know, do I? My job is to ask questions, and it's bloody hard asking questions of someone who isn't here.
Jazz says,
we know he has tunnels dug under his place.
Han and Nora went down to intercept him, in case he made it that far. She pulls up her comlink.
Solo!
Nothing but a crackle.
Solo! Report in!
Comes a voice. Sounds like the smuggler. And he doesn't sound good.
What happened?
She asks.
That big-headed freak surprised me. Was...
Over the comm come more groans, followed by a fit of coughing.
Was riding a hover chair, and the damn thing shocked the hell out of me when I reached for him.
What happened to Nora?
I don't know where she is. Before Aram came through, she said she was going to check something out. And then I got suckered.
She has to remind herself Aram really isn't their mission. He's Solo's problem. And if Solo let him go, well, that's that. Jazz will tell Temin to have Mr. Bones bag and tag the smuggler. They'll toss him in the back of the Halo and fly him back to Chandrilla. Just the same, where is Nora? As if on cue, another crackle, as Nora's voice comes over the comm.
I got him.
You got who? Aram?
I did.
How?
I followed one of the sub-tunnels out. It ended up at a small solar shuttle prepped on a platform. The nav computer was already loaded with a destination. Seems Aram has family on Seleucami. I hid. Aram hopped in, tried to take off. I stunned him. He's heavy, though. I could use a flyby. Bring the Halo in to pick up the prize?
Jazz grins ear to ear.
You got it, boss.
Chapter 21.
The prime operator within all Imperial ranks was the human being. Aliens were by and large unwelcome within its labyrinthine order, because aliens were seen as different. They were serfs and slaves, or at best, obstacles. They needed to be tamed, removed, or ignored. At least, so spoke the propaganda. Singir felt the tug of that prejudice himself from time to time, for it was so programmed into them that even near humans were to receive a measure of distrust. Palpatine and his propaganda machine worked to drive that nail of bigotry deeper by demonstrating how the old Jedi thugs and the scumfroth rebels consisted of many more non-humans than humans. You could trust a human, the Empire said. Aliens would always betray you. Of course, over time, Singir learned the foolishness of that, because as it turned out, human beings were fairly horrible, full of treachery, just brimming with the stuff. He came to believe that the Empire's corruption was precisely because it was xenophobic. It afforded no one any other voice. and so man and machine ruled the Empire together, while the rest of the galaxy, despite being predominantly non-human in origin, suffered, powerless, while under the twisting heel of the Imperial boot. Whatever the case, Sinjir's training as a loyalty officer gave him little opportunity to, extract information from non-humans. He was acutely aware of the physiological pain points of the human animal. Aliens, not so much. And so when presented with a cinetine, it took him some time. The cinetine frame is similar to that of most human beings, with the exception of the cranium. There, the alien's head is large, twice that of the average person's skull, and, well, squishy. The human head is protected by that precious mantle of bone, but the cinetine head seems like little more than a leather sack full of meat. The creature's brain is so immense that it literally strains against the inside of the wrinkling skin. No way to know, then, if Golas Aram's attitude was typical of the species, but the cinetine cared little for the sanctity of his body. Sinjir threatened to pull the alien apart like a warm sweet roll, but Aram was not forthcoming. The threat failed to land. Aram's legs were already ruined, and he traveled around on a hovering repulsor chair. Sinjir decided to go back to his own instincts then. This he learned from practice, and not the ISB loyalty manual. But sometimes it was valuable just to let someone talk. And so he talked at some length with Aram. About the droids, his compound, his ship, the planet Iridiru. Anything and everything. Aram didn't want to talk, and remained belligerent the whole way. He infused even the stiffest rebuke with alarming ego.
My droids are custom-built, and programmed in a way that no one else in the galaxy could duplicate. My compound was designed to be impenetrable. You primates were beneficiaries of luck is all that it was. Iridiru? Better here than anywhere else in the galaxy. Seems every other system is choking on the fat and stupidity of a torpid, indolent population. Fools. Fools everywhere.
Golas Aram thought very little of the rest of the galaxy, and quite a lot of himself. In particular, his intellect. He cared very little about his body, true, but he cared a great deal about his mind. That, then, is the approach Sinjir takes. He tells Aram,
I wonder, Golas, what would happen if I took, say, a knife or something long and sharp like this bit here?
He snatches a small antenna off the top of one of Temin's crates of random parts here in the main hold of the halo. He twirls it about, then tap, tap, taps it against the cinetine's head.
And I wonder, what if I pressed it through the folds? Or inserted it through one of your ear holes? An urgent push and then a pop as it sticks into your brain.
He teases it around the cinetine's ear hole, working it just inside.
What? What are you doing? You ape! Stop it!
Sinjir slides the antenna deeper, pushing. Aram cries out,
It would be a terrible thing. I'm just some clumsy, graceless primate, right? I would have no idea what I was even accomplishing. One wonders if it would have a deleterious effect on your own intelligence. I might even suggest it could turn you as lack-witted as someone like me. All that genius stored up. If I popped that balloon, would it come leaking out?
There. Fear in his eyes. Bright and alive, like light reflecting off rippling water. Every person is a lock, and Sinjir is adept at finding the key. The one that undoes them, unbundles them, opens them up, so that all within is fresh for the taking. It is a moment that has in the past given him great joy. Not this time. Instead, he pushes out of the hold and steps out of the ship. To the others gathered in the morning light of Iridiru, he says,
"He's ready. Go ask him whatever."
Then he staggers forward through the thirst grass, failing to feel the pain of its blades. The sun is over the horizon now. Gone are its gilded fingers splaying across the grass. It's just a throbbing white ball in the sky. Sinjir sits outside on a stack of boxes, staring off at nothing. Someone blots out the sun. It's Solo.
"You did it,"
the smuggler says.
"Aram?"
"I know."
"He gave us everything we needed."
Solo has a ragged, feral grin. He's excited, raring to go like a hound straining at its leash.
"Very glad to have been of service."
"You're Imperial."
"Ex."
"I don't like Imperials."
"Join the club. Even Imperials don't like Imperials."
"You did good. Get yourself cleaned up. Me and Nora are going to head into Kai Pompos, do a quick supply run. Then we're off to the races."
Sinjir offers a weak thumbs up.
"Yay."
Solo is gone, soon replaced by Jazz as she comes off the ship, bantering with Jom Burrell.
"Oh joy, he's back."
The two of them came down off the plateau last night just as he was about to be overrun by a pack of commando droids. One's apparently set to cook off like fireworks. Jazz and Jom saved him. Sinjir supposes he should be grateful. And he is. Maybe. Eventually, Jazz gives him a wink.
"You okay?"
she asks.
"Golden,"
he responds, summoning a liar's smile. Then she and Burrell are gone. Off to do whatever it is they do. Probably thump like engine pistons.
"Hey, Sinjir,"
says Temin, coming up from behind him.
"Hello, boy."
"You don't look so hot."
"That's rude."
"No, I mean..."
Temin laughs nervously.
"You seem like something's bothering you."
"Something's always bothering me. The sun, the air, other people. Nosy younglings who pop by with rude questions."
"I don't know what crawled up your exhaust port and died. But fine, I'm out of here. See you, Sinjir."
"Wait."
The boy pauses and looks back.
"What?"
"Back on Chandrilla, looking in on Yuktashu. That bothered you?"
"Yeah, sure."
"Why?"
"I don't know. Would have bothered anybody."
"Mm-mm. I don't buy that answer. It hit you like a fast little meteorite fragment. Right between the eyes."
Temin kicks a few stones, then says,
"Okay. You tell me what's bothering you, I'll tell you what bothered me."
"A little tit-for-tat, hmm? Fine. I don't want to be who I am anymore. I want to be someone different."
"You are. You're one of the good guys now."
"And as one of those good guys, I just threatened another sentient being with the act of sticking an antenna through his ear and into his brain."
"So why'd you do it then?"
Sinjir scowls like he's tasting something foul.
"Because history demands distasteful things be done to preserve it. Because being good sometimes means still being bad. Because it's who I am. And if I didn't do it, we'd probably still be sitting here scratching ourselves, wondering whatever could we do. I'm here for a reason. I'm a tool that fulfills a very exclusive function. What good am I if I don't fill it?"
"You're good in a lot of ways."
"Such as?" Right. Your turn."
"No, wait. I feel bad. You're really good at..."
"Too late. Buzzer is buzzing. Alarm is alarming. Your turn," I said. "You, me, Yuktashu. You were upset." "Why?"
"Because."
"Because is not an answer. It's an empty word.
because of my father.
Sinjir cocks an eyebrow. What about him?
He's maybe out there, too. In a cell, just like that one. I think who knows what happened to him, what happened to his mind. It made me worry that he might be broken, too. And if I ever find him, maybe he won't even recognize me. Maybe even if we find him, he'll still be lost. You know?
I do know. Quite profound, actually.
It is?
For a nosy youngling.
For the record, you're good at this kind of stuff, talking to people.
Oh, gross. I'd rather be good at torturing them.
Jerk.
Twit.
Temin laughs.
Thanks, Sinjir. I feel better.
For a time, so does Sinjir. He'd never say as much out loud, of course. He tries to enjoy the respite from his own foul mood, because he wonders, what comes now?
Part 4, Chapter 22. The Falcon slices through hyperspace.
You look nervous,
Han says to Nora, sitting in the co-pilot's chair, a chair that has a very deep seat and is lower to the floor than the other, a chair worn most often by a much bigger individual. Like, say, a Wookiee.
I'm not nervous,
she says. She's nervous. It's hard not to be. She's admired this ship a great deal from afar.
How could she not?
This should be a clunky, junky freighter. But she's seen it move. The way it whips and dips through the chaos of battle is a thing to behold. Performance like that steals your breath just watching it. She and her Y-Wing followed the Falcon, then piloted by Calrissian and his Sullustan co-pilot, into the maze-like innards of the second Death Star. It was a thing to marvel. A sight she will never forget. That's from the outside. On the inside? She's surprised this thing holds together. It's got the structural integrity of a sack of spare parts. Nothing matches. Things dangle. Wires lie exposed. Panels don't match their moorings. The console doesn't even look original to the ship. It's like her son built it in his workshop back on Akiva. Bits sit welded to other bits, or worse, are stuck together with wound-up wads of bonding tape and shellacked over with shiny epochs. Nora is afraid this thing might break into pieces right here in the middle of rocketing through hyperspace. Solo, for his part, seems like he's embraced the chaos of it. Sometimes an alarm goes off, or part of the dash goes dark, and then he pounds it with the side of his fist, or jiggles the wires hanging underneath. And it all comes back online. He smirks and winks. Nora, in order to not talk about the orbital garbage fire in which they are currently traveling, says,
"We sure Aram gave us good info?"
We'll find out, won't we? If his codes don't check out, we're gonna have to get out of there fast as a blaster.
He closes his eyes and pinches the flesh at the center of his brow.
You know what? It'll work. It has to work.
Because, she knows, this is their only shot. Kashyyyk is a prison planet. A worldwide labor camp. The Empire and its xenophobic monstrousness saw fit to imprison and enslave the Wookiees there, not because they offered a meaningful threat to the Emperor's ascendancy, but because they were different, and because their massive, robust physiology would allow them to work long and hard in extreme conditions. Probably took rather epic effort to work a Wookiee to death. Not that the Empire wouldn't try, she wagers. At that, she fails to repress a shudder.
It'll work, she says,
because it has to work. Solo reaches above him, sets the stabilizers with a few flips of a few switches.
We're coming up on it. You ready for this?
No. Yes.
Dropping out of light speed.
He gives a quick tap to the nav computer screen, then eases back on the throttle. The long light lines go from streaks to stars. And there is their destination. Kashyyyk. A green, verdant planet. She spies snow-capped mountains and snaking rivers leading to oceans of dark water. But above all else are the forests. Even from here the forests pop. The clouds swirling above atmosphere have to swirl around and through the trees. But look closer, and you see devastation. Patches of forest gone, dark and gray. Rivers stem to a trickle. Black dots across the seas. Imperial undersea mining platforms, she guesses. White clouds swirl into hurricanes of black smoke. If she can see the destruction from all the way out here, in space, how bad is it on the ground? What have they done to this world? All around the planet hangs the Imperial blockade. Dozens of ships, a pair of Star Destroyers, a handful of battleships, plus shuttle traffic and patrols of TIE starfighters. "We should have come in an Imperial ship," she says. Behind them, a blip on the scanners. Another craft dropping out of hyperspace. Her heart tightens in her chest, even though she knows that ship. It's the Halo, following behind. Jazz is piloting it. The rest of the crew is with her, leaving Nora to accompany the smuggler.
"I said it'll be fine," Solo says. "We didn't have time, anyway."
"Surely they know your ship."
"They do. But we got Aram's Imperial codes, remember? Besides, they think the Falcon is destroyed."
"How's that?"
"After I lost Chewie, I hired a slicer to hack the Empire's networks. See if I could find out anything. While in there, she did me a favor and updated their records on me and the Falcon. I'm listed as dead. And this ship is listed as having gone kaboom."
She hesitates. "And our gunship?"
"Like I said, your gunship is an SS-54. Fortunately for us, Imperial bureaucracy is an immovable object. Once upon a time, the Empire classified that ship as a light freighter. Would take mountains of paperwork and official approvals to get it redesignated in their databases. So, they don't see a gunship. They see a freighter."
"That keeps our story, then."
"Sure does, lady. Sure does."
That story? They're bringing parts and a repair crew down to the surface of Kashyyyk to do repairs on the prison known as Ashmead's Lock, at the behest of the prison's designer, Golas Aram. Simple, clean. As if on cue, the comm crackles.
"This is Star Destroyer Dominion. You are in illegal approach of Imperial Territory G5623. Identify yourselves and transmit clearance codes, or you will be marked as a trespasser and in violation of galactic code."
Han clears his throat and gives a nervous smile to Nora, possibly meant to reassure her before speaking.
"This is Light Freighter Conveyance, accompanied by Light Freighter, the Swan. Stand by for code transmission."
He gives the nod, and Nora uploads the codes. Silence on the other end.
"They're not buying it," she says.
"They're buying it."
More silence.
"They're not buying it."
"They haven't charged up their weapons."
A burst of static across the comm. Then,
"What is your purpose on the surface of Imperial Territory G5623, Conveyance?"
We're sent to do repairs on an old prison. We were sent by Golas Aram at the request of the Empire. We have technical parts in the crew to install them. Sir.
More silence. Nora hears only the blood rushing in her ears.
"Not today. Turn your ships around and please exit Imperial space."
Han's brow furrows with frustration. He gets back on the comm.
"I apologize. I don't understand, sir. The code clearance..."
"The planet is on lockdown, Freighter Conveyance. No one in, no one out. By order of Emperor Palpatine himself."
Palpatine? Nora sits forward in her pilot seat. Chills run roughshod over her skin, and she can't shake them off. Could he be alive? After all this? Solo whispers to her.
He's dead. Relax.
Then back on the comm.
Sir, I apologize. I was to understand that the Emperor did not survive.
Then you understand poorly. The Emperor is alive and well. Imperial Territory G5623 is under quarantine. I repeat, turn around or we will be forced to open fire.
Panic traps both of them in its grip. Han and Nora look at each other. His eyes are wild. He's like a caged animal, desperate to chew its way through the enclosure. He reaches for the weapon systems. Nora catches his hand. What are you doing?
What do you mean, what am I doing? We're gonna blast our way through this. You know, the old-fashioned way of doing things.
They've got two Star Destroyers there.
Oh, hey, thanks for that update. By the way, the Falcon's punched its way through a lot worse. We'll make it to the surface.
And what then?
Then we head to the coordinates Aram gave us.
With half the Empire on our tails?
I don't mind those odds, sister.
She grabs for the comm and speaks into it, desperate for a solution. Except it's not the Imperials she hails. Instead, she routes her comm through to the Halo. Jazz answers.
Nora, I don't think they're interested.
I know. Get Sinjir. The shuffling of fabric. Then Sinjir's voice crackles over the dash.
You called?
I need something. A code. Imperial. Emergency. High ranking. Something. Anything that will get us planet side.
Oh, damn. It's been a while. Tell them it's a 999327. That's a classified work order code.
She flips the comm back. Star Destroyer Dominion, she says. This is the conveyance. I'm told to try one last time, sir. We are here at the demand of Grand Admiral Ray Sloan and Imperial Advisor Yup Tishu. It's a wild shot in the dark, her plucking two names of powerful people, two of whom she has personally encountered, and hoping those names have enough power.
We are here to service Ashmead's Lock, a prison that contains high-value prisoners. Prisoners assigned to this prison by the Emperor himself. Sir, we have a work order. 999327?
She repeats it. Even as she speaks the words, she knows how little a chance it gives them. So what then? Blast their way through, apparently? Which she is pretty sure will be a death sentence.
Hold,
comes the voice. Han gives her a look.
They're not gonna buy it.
I know.
When they don't buy it, I'm gonna blast our way onto that planet.
I know that too.
Better buckle up then. It's about to get...
Conveyance, this is Dominion. You are clear to land.
The breath that leaves Nora's chest leaves her shaking.
You were saying, Captain Solo? About to get what?
Don't get cocky, lady. Nobody likes a preening peacock. Let's get planetside before they change their mind.
The call comes across her holoscreen in the middle of a meeting with the Shadow Council. Brendel Hux is at one end of the table, bellowing at Rand, the former red-cheeked, and with a vein throbbing across his brow. The latter, standing stiff as a flagpole and looking rather bored. Sloane's device pings with the call from a Star Destroyer. The Dominion, in the Kashyyyk system.
If you'll excuse me, she says,
and the men all stop and give her a quizzical, irritated look. Idiots. She steps out of the room and into one of the Ravager's austere steel hallways. She takes the call. On her screen, Rear Admiral Urien Orlan appears. He's a plastic-cheeked, bird-nosed little man. She never much cared for him. He was a hesitant commander, one of the weakest she knew. And yet he accelerated past her in years previous, ironically giving command of a Star Destroyer named Dominion. Orlan has dominion over very little except his hair, which is so perfectly placed against his brow, she suspects it's fake.
This is a courtesy call, he says.
Not courteous enough to defer to my authority, she says. Here, let me help you. Greetings, Grand Admiral Sloan. It is my most distinct pleasure to be speaking to you today, sir. Try that on for size, Urien.
He licks his lips and says,
Yes, of course, Grand Admiral. It is a pleasure.
The truth is, G5623 is one of those Imperial territories that has not yet properly fallen in line with the rest. Like a Noat, they're still telling the myth that Palpatine is alive and well. That he's not merely some demonic ghost commanding an empire from beyond the grave, but he escaped the exploding Death Star by improbable, even miraculous means. They remain fairly self-sufficient, so much so that this remnant has holed up there, protecting itself overmuch from outside influence.
What is it, Urien?
I was wondering about the prison.
What prison would that be?
Ashmead's Lock, here on G5623.
I'm not familiar with it.
His nose twitches.
Are you quite sure?
Do you think me a fool or a liar?
I do not, of course. It's just, we had two ships. We turned them away, but they insisted they had a code clearance from, well, you.
Describe these ships to me.
He does, sending rudimentary schematics to her screen. Two light freighters, a YT-1300, and an SS-54. The latter is really a gunship, misdiagnosed as a freighter. It's not for carrying parts. She's dealt with two ships of those models before. It's an unusual combination. Too unlikely to be a coincidence.
Could it be the Millennium Falcon and the ship belonging to the Bounty Hunter? The Halo, is it?
That's the same crew that slipped from her grip on Akiva. The same crew, in fact, that's been hunting down Imperials, often getting to them before she could. At least Mercurial dispatched that last one right out from under them.
And the Falcon belongs to General Solo.
Robbing the New Republic of someone like him isn't militarily significant, but the damage it would do to their morale, though, it could also provoke them into a fight for which they aren't yet ready. Whatever the case, the incursion cannot stand.
Sir?
Admiral Orlan asks.
Send a team to investigate, she tells him. Report back.
He hesitates. The chain of command is no longer what it used to be. Orlan is a man of different masters. Why even call her, then? Perhaps to stay just enough on her good side, in case he's forced to make a choice.
I'll have to check with Grand Moff Tolrok, if he approves.
Tell him he will approve, or he will see a visit from me.
Yes. Yes, sir. Of course, sir.
And then, Admiral Urien Orlan is gone. She turns around and finds she's not alone. Admiral Rax stands there, silent as a specter. His black-gloved hands are clasped in front of him.
Everything all right? He asks.
She might as well tell him. He probably already knows. So Sloane spills the story. His face registers no surprise.
Call Orlan back, Rax says. Tell him we did approve the repairs on the prison.
But we did no such thing.
No, but we're doing it now.
The two ships. I believe they belong to known New Republic malefactors. The crew of Imperial Hunters seems to have joined ranks with one of the Rebellion's cultural heroes, General Solo. Taking them out
is the wrong fight.
How is that exactly?
He rests a gentle hand on her shoulder, though it feels to her like it weighs 1,000 kilograms.
A light touch that could crush her.
Placating and condescending to boot.
Admiral Sloane, we do not want to goad them into a fight right now. We are on the cusp of making our attack on Chandrila. We don't want to give them any sign that it's coming.
No preemptive attacks.
We must appear weak. They must be bloated with overconfidence.
This is wrong.
Trust me. I have it all in hand. Which reminds me, the instruments are nearly all lined up, and the music has been written. It is time to perform the song. Chandrila must fall, but first, I need your help. She hesitates. It feels like she's getting into bed with a viper.
How?
I have a task. He tells her what it is. And when he does, she cannot help feel like she's being ushered toward another test. Or worse, a trap.
I'll do it, she says. And I'll make sure Admiral Orlan knows that we did, in fact, approve of the work on G5623.
Good, he says, and reaches forward and kisses her brow. His lips are cold. Her whole body tenses up as he performs the gesture, a gesture made as if he is blessing her somehow. She wants to vomit. When he's gone, she does indeed call Orlan. But then she makes another call, because someone is going to go to the Kashi system on her behalf. She will not let this opportunity escape her. It is her life preserver, and she will hold on tight.
Chapter 23. Jazz has a bad feeling about this. She eases the halo along, following the path set by the Falcon just ahead. It's night, but even in the half-dark, it's easy to see. This planet is sick. The trees here are some of the biggest she's ever seen, bigger than some of the sky towers and complexes of Coruscant. But the trees are dead. Their massive trunks are splintering, and in those fissures shine the kaleidoscopic bioluminescence of spores and fungus, painting the trees in a diseased glow. The branches are skeletal things, reaching for the sky as if to drag the stars down to the ground and bury them in grave dirt. The Falcon winds through those dry, decrepit branches. The halo follows close. It's John who says it.
There's nothing here. Nothing and no one.
He's right. No other ships. No lights beneath the dead canopies. Just that swimmy, contaminated glow. The others gather behind her in the cockpit. She grunts at them to back up and back off. But of course, nobody listens to her. They're all too busy gaping. Where are the Wookiees? The Imperials? Anything? This is just one part of the planet, she knows. And Kashyyyk is a big planet. It has cities. This is as far flung from any of those cities as they'll get, according to her admittedly outdated maps. But just the same, this is where they're supposed to be. And it is a lifeless place. What could the rest of the world look like? There, Temin says, pointing over her shoulder. She swats his hand away, but follows his finger regardless. Jazz can barely make it out, but way down on the surface, she sees it. A faint shape of something big. A structure. Ashmead's Lock. It must be. The coordinates Aram gave them are right on then. Solo and Nora must see it too, because the Falcon swoops low. Jazz turns the gunship's engines vertical, bringing it into hover. As they descend, they move past crooked, busted platforms and rotten structures barely hanging on to the side of the trees. Jazz flips on a narrow-band spotlight so they can see what they're looking at. The head is an old gun emplacement, a massive bolt thrower hanging loose from its mooring, swinging gently from tangled vines. It's a Wookiee weapon. Like a bowcaster, but big enough to take down a craft or a small ship. Then they pass another structure. Not big enough to be a house. A guard station, maybe? It clings to the side of the tree, lashed there with fraying rope. A corpse hangs out of the doorway. A desiccated carcass. The hair on it gone dry as broom bristles. Mostly it's just a pelt stuck to bones. A dead Wookiee, she thinks. A gun still dangling from its shoulder strap. The ground is a long way down. They see more dilapidated structures. More bodies. More rot and more ruin. And then the ground eases up to meet them. The Falcon finds a proper landing platform. A concrete abutment jutting up and out of a tangle of twisting thorn. Jazz finds a clear spot of ground and settles the halo into it. The engines burn and blast away some of that unruly underbrush. Ahead, by a quarter kilometer, is the prison. Or rather, prison ship. It looks like what Aram told them is true. Ashmead's Lock is not a prison he built. It's a prison ship from the old Republic days. A ship run by some rogue empire. An enemy of the Republic, he said. The Praedori, he called them. Whoever they were, they're gone now. The ship once held captives of the old Republic and sat in the center of some massive gravity well. How better to keep prisoners from escaping than by sticking them into a ship capable of resisting the crushing implosive force of a gravitational hollow? Easy to get in, impossible to escape. But one day, everything fell apart. Aram said that well must have fallen in onto itself, sending the ship plunging to the world below. And it crashed into the surface of Kashyyyk, where it sat for hundreds, even thousands of years. The Wookiees believed it cursed. A place haunted by bad spirits. They made it forbidden to come here. They stood vigil in case anything ever came out of it. And then, one day, the Empire came. The Imperials found no such fear of the artifact, and were instead more than happy to refurbish the old ship into performing its task once more. And who better to turn it into a black site prison than Golos Aram? The prison ship sits in the distance, illuminated with but a single light atop it. A shimmering blue crystal, bathing everything in an eerie radiance. It matches the creepy fungal glow from above, and serves well to further stir the septic feeling roiling around in Jazz's stomach. They all exit the halo. Beneath them, the ground is hard and dry and cracked. The undergrowth is brittle, snapping like little bones as they walk. They gather together behind the trunks of one of the gargantuan trees.
"This is it,"
Solo says.
"Doesn't look like anybody's home,"
Nora says.
"You're sure Chewbacca is in this place?"
He scowls.
"He has to be. All the records pointed me here."
"Can we all reach the uncomfortable agreement that this is very likely a trap?"
Singier says.
"I mean, the records pointed you here. Some old derelict ghost ship in an obliterated bit of forest, which says to me that we're about to stick our foot into an ill-concealed snare."
"Yes? Hello?"
"It's not a trap," Solo growls. "Can't be. Chewie's in there. I can feel it. The Empire doesn't have it together enough to put a trick together like that anymore. And if they wanted us dead or in shackles, they could have done it before we ever got down here to the surface. We're doing this."
Jazz hesitates.
"I don't think we should."
"Then stay out here. I don't care. I'm going in."
With that, Solo steps out from behind the tree and begins his march toward the prison. He ducks his head low and darts forward, blaster in hand.
"Nora,"
Jazz says,
"something's up, and he's blind to it."
"I know, but he needs our help."
Nora sighs.
"Tem, you and Bone stay out here."
"Whoa, come on! We want in on the action!"
"No, you don't. And the action might come up on our tails while we're in there. And if it does, you're our rear guard."
He rolls his eyes.
"Fine.
The rest of us, we're with Solo. But stay frosty. I don't know what we're expecting to find in here. Aram said the prison was automated, but that it had defense mechanisms. Thankfully, his codes are supposed to get us past those mechanisms. Cross your fingers, toes, and tentacles.
Nora draws her own blaster.
We're going in.
It's Bones who opens the door. One of the talon-tipped claws on his hand flips back, and a data link adapter emerges. He hums to himself as he jams it into the port. The interface mechanism spins right, then left, then buzzes all the way around as the modded B-1 battle droid uploads the code. It works. The door slides open. Nora tells her son,
"Stay here. Use the comm link if you need us."
Temin wants to go.
He's good at this sort of thing. Staying out here will be boring.
And though he wouldn't admit it out loud,
creepy. But he decides to play nice.
He is learning to trust his mother. He gives a reluctant nod, and then the rest of them go inside as he and Bones wait by the door. The droid sways back and forth, rocking to some imperceptible tune. He clicks and clacks his talons against his skeletal legs, creating an erratic beat.
Temin shushes him. "We gotta be quiet, Bones."
"Roger, roger, Master Temin."
"Just keep an eye out."
"Okie dokie."
"And be ready for anything."
"Ready to eviscerate anything."
"That's not exactly what I said."
He shrugs.
"But close enough."
Inside, darkness. Complete and total. Nora can't see Solo in front of her. Can't see the others behind her. How could a prison like this sit here in the dark for so... One by one, the lights come on, cascading down a long hall, fixture by fixture. The brightness washes everything out, and Nora winces against it. As her eyes adjust, she can start to make out the layout of the ship. The hall ahead. Two sets of stairs going up on each side. Metal walkways above, each illuminated by lines of red light. Beyond that, above, are porthole windows glowing blue. Everything is shiny and chrome. Walls like black mirrors.
Han blinks, then cocks an eyebrow. "All right, we're in."
He keeps his voice low when he says,
"We're going to split up. Me and the bounty hunter are going to stay on this floor. Nora, you take the Imperial and the new guy."
"Hey,"
John protests. Jazz snickers.
"And head to the upper floors. We're looking for, I don't know what, the bridge, a control station. Above all else, we're looking for Chewie and the other prisoners the Empire took that day. Clear?"
"As a sunny day," Nora says.
"Let's do this."
Han and Jazz skulk off, sticking to the lower level. Nora has Sinjir and Jom form up behind her as they take to the second floor. Nora keeps her blaster out, not pointed at anything, and her finger on the guard, not on the trigger. Wedge was fond of giving everyone lectures about trigger discipline, which means not putting your finger on that trigger until you're just ready to pull it. Wedge. She misses him. She understands his choice not to come along. He's a pilot for the New Republic. He has his loyalties. And yet, she's angry at him too. Because he's a part of this. He should do like she did and follow her heart.
"Oh, that's just absurd, isn't it?"
She chastises herself for the thought. Follow her heart where? To a prison ship on a slave planet? Maybe Wedge had the right idea after all. The moment they reach the second floor is when the silence of the ship is suddenly broken. A voice comes over the comm speakers, filling the whole ship with its booming presence. A voice that vacillates between male and female as it runs through a series of babbled languages. Nora recognizes some, like Ithorese, Gand, and Hutties. But not all. It races through them almost as if calibrating itself. Then it begins to speak in a language they all understand.
Life forms 80% human, 20% Zabrak. Attuning language to basic. Greetings, trespassers. This is Praetorian prison ship Ashmead's Lock. I am the ship's IPU, or Intellectual Processing Unit. Designation SOL-GBA. Synthesized Operating Layer, Grid-Based Drive Array. Welcome to my ship. Please speak the passcode aloud to continue.
Syngier almost laughs. What did it say?
What did it say is not an acceptable passcode. One out of three attempts used. Please speak the passcode aloud to continue.
Nora sticks her finger up against her lips to shush Syngier and Jom before they say anything else. Whatever this passcode is, Aram never gave it to them. That means he set them up. Because of course he did. Damn it! Why did the system trigger so late? Why not when they first stepped inside? A grim thought enters her mind. All the better to trap us here. She starts to flag them to turn around and head back down the steps. Best to leave now and reformulate the plan. But then the computer, now settling on a female voice, says,
What the hell is this? Is not an acceptable passcode. Two out of three attempts used. Please speak the passcode aloud to continue.
Solo. Damn it! She mouths the word move three times over, and they start heading back down the steps.
A voice bellows from somewhere below. Solo again.
Give me the damn Wookiee, you crazy computer!
And of course, SOL-GDA's response is...
Give me the damn Wookiee, you crazy computer, is not an acceptable passcode. Three out of three attempts used. Passcode failed. System moving to lockdown. Please remain still for incorporation.
Lockdown? Incorporation? That doesn't sound good at all, does it? Nora waves her arms, urging the others forward. The ship begins to rumble. A low, mechanized growl, accompanied by a high-pitched whine that drills deep into her ear. Above them, and alongside them, the black mirrors begin to slide back with a whir. Out of each newly exposed chamber steps a pair of droids. Their faces are polished mirrors. Not black like the walls, but rather a burnished gunmetal. The arms of the droids are configured like skeletal spines. Countless joints allowing the hyper-flexible limbs to drag behind them like tentacles. They lean forward with the predatory gait of a hungry beast. Feet clicking as they begin to lope toward Nora and the others. Already she hears Solo blast her and the bounty hunter slug thrower. She fires her own. Run! She screams. But down below, more droids are rushing up to meet them. The way out is locked and blocked, so the bounty hunter and the smuggler go the only direction they can. They hard charge it deeper into the bowels of the prison ship. Solo's just ahead, bolting forward, his blaster spinning lasers. Jazz fires her slug thrower from the hip as she follows. Ahead, droids lurch and lunge, their whip-like arms lancing the air. But they go down, one by one. Solo's lasers take their legs out from under them. Her slugs punch holes through those mirrored masks as they fall. Droid heads whipping back, vomiting sparks. The machine beings clattering hard against the floor and skidding. One comes out of the wall at the smuggler. The tip of its segmented arm glistens. A needle, she thinks. It stabs towards Solo's neck. No time to do anything else. She fires. The slug shears off the end of the attacker's limb, sending up a spray of hot metal chips. Solo cries out, clapping his free hand against his neck as he staggers against the wall. Keep moving, she hisses in his ear as she comes up behind him, shouldering him forward.
You shot me.
I shot near you.
His hand comes away wet and red. Ahead, more droids. He sneers and draws the second blaster at his hip and peppers the hallway ahead with searing light. Droid spin and spark. They pass an adjoining passageway, and she catches his elbow with her hand.
There, down that way, an open space, and what looks to be some kind of command center.
Han Solo fires off a few more shots and follows after her. Jazz hopes the others have found somewhere safe, too. They're everywhere! Nora's on the ground, her back against the metal, her blaster up and firing at a droid diving toward her. Her shock tears the thing's faceless mask off, exposing a sizzling circuit board. It collapses against her, limbs flailing uselessly against the metal. She rolls it off her and fires two more shots into its open skull. It stops moving. Jom is just ahead, thrashing about as two of them crawl up on him, pinning him to the wall even as he bashes one in the skull with the butt of his rifle and kicks the other away. Two more swiftly replace those that fell. A segmented arm coils around his blaster and twists it from his grip. He headbutts the thing in return. It bloodies his nose. His skull cracks the thing's mask in two. Nora stands steady and lines up a shot. She hears the click-clack behind her just as something, a lash-like limb, curls around her neck and tightens. A sound comes out of her. And instantly, her head starts to pulse and throb as the blood pools and her airway closes. Everything seems to go oozing and slow. Jom goes down as one of the droids sticks a needle in his neck. She can't even see Sinjir, but then when her head is wrenched back, she spies the ex-Imperial up, up, up above her as the droid crawls up the walls, carrying him with it toward an open portal glowing blue. Then a needle sticks into her neck with a stabbing prick. She tries to cry out, but can't. Her body goes weak. It's as if her limbs aren't even hers anymore. Like they're just sacks of meat stapled to her torso. She tries to do something, anything, but the blaster clacks against the ground, and her vision starts to smear like grease on a window. She begins to fly, lifting up off the ground, and for a moment, she feels giddy. I'm escaping. I'm flying. But that's not it at all. They're carrying her, just like they did Sinjir.
Where are they taking me? What are they going to do to me? Help! Someone! Anyone!
She chokes, and darkness sweeps the light aside. Mr. Bones sits cross-legged on the ground in front of the door. He has his vibroblade out, and it crackles and spits as he saws through a stick, one cut after the next, until he's got a little cairn of equally sized stick bits in front of him. He sweeps the pile away, then grabs another stick to begin anew.
What are you doing? Temin asks.
Cutting things.
Why?
I enjoy it.
He shrugs.
Fair enough.
The droid is weird. He knows that. He programmed Bones to be functional, yes, but also independent in his own way. Problem is, Temin isn't really sophisticated enough to know exactly what he did when creating his bodyguard's personality matrix. So what he got was this. Whatever. That's not important now. What matters is,
they haven't come out yet.
This is a true statement, Master Temin.
They should have come out.
The droid suddenly stands, as if eager.
Yes.
Which means they might be in danger.
I enjoy danger, Master Temin.
The battle droid's vulture-like head tilts back and forth on its axis with little whirs and ticks. His jagged teeth gleam in the half-light. There's an eager tinge to the droid's discordant voice.
If they're not coming out, we may have to go in.
Will there be violence?
If they're in danger.
Bones' fingers tickle the air.
Then let us hope they are in danger, so that I may perform egregious violence.
One finger flips back, and the data link emerges, its fiber optic tip glowing.
May I open the door now?
Temmin snaps his fingers, suddenly nervous.
Yeah, Bones. Open her up. Please be okay, Mom.
Before he was excited for the promise of action. Now, though, that rush of excitement has been replaced by a river of fear. The door mechanism is cratered from one of Jazz's slugs, and the static arcs of electricity jump from it as it sizzles. She and Solo crouch down behind a bank of computers as the droids work to cut through the door. The room they're in is hexagonal. It's out in the open, in a massive central area seen easily through the scalloped windows that surround them. The windows are thankfully impenetrable blast glass. The droids continue to hammer against them with their lashing arms, but so far they've only served to scratch the surface. The door, though? They'll come through that soon. The computers aren't like anything Jazz has ever seen. No keypad. Just a smooth, convex bubble sitting in the front of a green hollow screen. When Solo's hands move across the bubble, the monitor flits from screen to screen. None of it in